The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank, good evening and welcome to The Money Show this evening. I'm looking forward to bringing you what should be a fascinating show for you tonight. We've got the chief executive of Sibanye Stillwater on The Money Show later, Neil Froneman, coming to talk to us about money. This is the chief executive of a company whose workers in its gold division are on strike over pay, and that strike could spill over to the platinum division. And in the era where pay disclosure is mandatory, does it help, I wonder, the negotiations process? So we'll talk about that tonight. It should be an absolutely fascinating discussion. Also learn a bit more about him, where he grew up and his what he does with money. And then also this evening, the threats to MultiChoice's dominance in the television market. We'll look at that in some detail. It's one of our stock picks tonight, which is interesting. So we'll do that later on. Ian Mann with his book of the week. We'll talk to a guy who runs a business dealing with one of the most delicate and sensitive and tragic areas of our lives. I mean, loss is deep and profound in all of our lives. And for many people, the loss of an animal is as deep and profound as a distant family member, perhaps. And so we'll talk to the guy who does that. He deals with taking away your deceased pet. And what happens? I just went past a vehicle the other day and I went, oh, that's interesting. We should talk to those people. So we're talking to those people. And then also this evening, Airbnb attempts to regulate Airbnb in South Africa. Massively contentious issue for tourism. That's all coming up on tonight's Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. And 92.7. And 106 FM.
But first, I want to give you some money. Of course, I can. I've been given 1,000 rand to give to you. To you, yeah, but you've got to get the answer right. It is our fast fact question, and it is a chance to win 1,000 rand in cash, courtesy of 702 Cape Talk and Altron. There, where it matters, today's fast fact question with Altron this evening. Who is recommending a Boeing rebrand on its troubled 737 MAX aircraft? Now, the way to enter this competition is either to SMS to 31702 or 31567, and Altron has got six letters, so we'll take the sixth correct SMS. Who is recommending a rebrand for the troubled 737 MAX aircraft? I would like the name of that person, please, spelled correctly and in full on 31702, 31567. Tikiso, yep, you. We'll take the sixth correct answer because Altron has six letters. That's 1,000 bucks courtesy of Altron this evening. If you think you know the answer to today's fast fact, the big reveal just before Eyewitness News at 6:30.
702. SMS Bruce on 31702.
Well, the newly published Tourism Amendment Bill aims to regulate Airbnb. It might even lead to limits on the number of nights that a guest can stay or how much income an Airbnb can earn. You go, hold on a second. This is quite interesting. If you looked at weekend newspaper headlines, you would have sworn that Airbnb was single-handedly killing tourism. Let's talk to Chifiwa Chibengwa, who is the Tourism Business Council of South Africa chief executive. Chifiwa, welcome back to The Money Show. Nice to have you with us. You represent, amongst others, FEDASA, which is the Federation of Hotels. As the Tourism Business Council, are you in support of regulation of Airbnb or opposed? What is your position?
Good evening, Bruce, and thank you for having me on your show. We do support the regulations. In actual fact, we have been discussing this amendment to the Tourism Act for the past few years, if I'm not mistaken, for about 2 years. When we started to talk about the impact that Airbnb is having on the formal accommodation industry, and this impact that it's having, at first, lots of people thought that this is not going to be a huge impact, but over the years, I've been getting calls from different hotel groups, smaller accommodation, saying to me, look, this is having impact. I've got a neighbor of mine, who has started who has Airbnb opposite a guest house. So it's starting to have a huge impact. And you can see that, with the declining occupancy rates and so forth and so on. But it's not the only factor.
Yeah, it most certainly isn't the only factor. I mean, we know, and you guys have been fighting the visa issue, but I'm interested into knowing why you as an industry body, in the interests of tourism, are interested in protecting a particular sector of the tourism industry and not the new, I don't know, the more advantageous, perhaps, to tourism. I mean, surely, if the Airbnb sector is more competitive than the hotel sector, then the Airbnb sector will encourage tourism. It'll drive people into areas where perhaps they haven't gone before. And if hotels can't compete, well, then the hotel sector is what needs reform, not regulation of the upstarts, the renegades.
Yeah, so let me just, you know, dissect this a little bit. So, you know, Airbnb is a platform, and there are other platforms, technological platforms, that do similar kind of things, where, you know, someone can go and list their property and, put it out for short-term rental, which is similar to what hotel does. The issue is not the technology that is available. The issue is that, you know, the technology is allowing, you know, those, you know, homes that are not hotels, that are not registered as business, to become hotels. Now, if we are to say that, you know what, let's do away with all the regulation, you know, that we put on hotels. Everyone, you know, for themselves, let's not have any standard. Let's not register as business. Let's not have liquor licenses. And let's not have safety and security and so forth and so on. We're going to have chaos in this space. So what we're saying is not that we are against the technology. Technology is great, and we adapt to technology as a tourism industry. What we are against is that, you know, the technology should not be free for all, whereby you have someone who has a second home in Cape Town or an apartment in Cape Town or Durban or wherever, who's listing that apartment, you know, 365, you know, and then they are earning income as a hotel.
Let me turn it upside down a little bit. Say, right, we're not talking here about registering the establishment. What about the consumer's choice? I mean, if I choose to stay in an unregulated, unregistered, unsecure bedroom in somebody's house, rather than go into the cold reception area of a hotel where I've got a disinterested receptionist who would rather be playing Xbox at home with their teenager, because we've all had that experience. What if I wanted to go into the warm confines of somebody's home? It's my choice as a consumer to take that risk, because that's what I'm choosing to do. You're saying I'm not allowed to take that risk because that person is competing unfairly with the person with the established hotel business.
Yeah. What we're saying, Bruce, is that let's have entry rules. What is it that, you know, a person who wants to rent their house or their room have to do as an entry rule? So we're not saying that they must be like hotels. We are saying that we can't just leave that space untouched, unregulated, whereby everyone can do, you know, whatever they want.
The hotel industry doesn't even have a reliable star grading system, Chifu. I mean, if the hotel industry had its ducks in a row and I knew that a one star was a one star, a two star was a two star, we've done away with the star system in South Africa simply because we couldn't administer that. The Tourism Grading Council, I know, is trying. But the hotel industry itself isn't in great shape. And now we wanted to protect a hotel industry that isn't in great shape from an industry that is stealing its lunch. And that seems a little bit self-defeating from an industry perspective, surely.
No, Bruce, it's not self-defeating. And also, let's look at it broader. You know, the Tourism Grading Council does a great work in terms of grading hotels. There's a minimum entry requirements. When we say this is a three-star, it must have certain things that we say minimum. The same as four or five-star and the same as one and two. This applies to all types of accommodation. Guest houses those who wants to stay in backpackers, there are grading criteria.
But nobody's forced to be graded, though, are they? I mean, there was a requirement a long time ago that you had to be graded. I mean, there were rules, and if you had a peephole in the door, then that counted for a star. And if you did this, if you had room service, that counted for a star. And there were a whole bunch of silly rules and regulations that no longer apply even in the hotel industry. Now, the hotel industry can't regulate itself on that regard, and now you want additional regulation because the hotel industry is being disrupted. And that's what the industry doesn't like.
No, Bruce, we are not being disrupted. What we are saying is that anyone who wants to operate in the space that we operate in, being a hotel or short-term rental, you know, they must have certain types of rules so that we can level the playing field. If we go now and we say, well, everyone to themselves...
Isn't the point of disruption to change the playing field, Chifua? If, I mean, if you said to Bank Zero and to Discovery Bank and you said to the guys at Time Digital, no, it's not fair that you're doing just digital banking. You guys must build branches too, because otherwise it's not fair, because the other banks have been around for 150 years and they've got branches, and it's really not fair. I mean, it's a bizarre conversation.
What we're talking about here is that, you know, when you have a residential home that you use as a business, you know, even the bylaws in that particular municipality will say, you know, you've got to register your home either as, you know, you're running a business or you're
a
resident.
Is it not a municipal requirement? Why must the Department of Transport be restricting the competition to the hotel sector?
No, we are not restricting competition. We are saying that everyone who plays in the space, you know, must play with certain types of rules. We can't have people that are not even registered as business, that are not following anything, competing with someone who is registered as business, you know, who also contribute to the employment, you know, in this country, also contribute to the taxes in this country, you know, in terms of income tax and so forth and so on. And then we have those that are benefiting from the money that's been collected from the industry that is being used by South African tourism to market this country overseas. And then when people come here, they're no longer staying at the establishments, you know, that contribute to that. And then we have these new establishments that don't contribute to anything that are benefiting from that. Yes, it does benefit tourism in a broader sense, but, you know, we need to really look at it and say, you know, how do we make sure that, you know, the established industry and the new industry or the disruption, they have certain rules that they could follow. Otherwise, this space will be chaotic. If we don't do anything about this situation.
I hear your argument, Chifua. Thank you. Chifua Chivengwa, thank you. He is the Chief Executive of the Tourism Business Council of South Africa. Rosalind Lake, who is Director at Norton Rose. I mean, this sounds like regulation heaven for lawyers and a regulation nightmare for anybody who really wants to participate in the tourism sector, Ros.
Good evening, Bruce. Yes, indeed. More regulation is what small businesses in South Africa need. So it's a very interesting debate, Bruce. And you know, as a competition lawyer, I shudder at the thought of any imposition of pricing restrictions or caps. But at the same time, one can empathise with the impact when you do have a lot of onerous obligations to operate as a business, and you find yourself competing against private individuals. So you can certainly understand where both sides are coming from.
Yeah, I mean, but does it need regulation from a competition perspective? Does it need regulation, or do we just need municipalities to be properly running their municipalities, to be checking whether people are running businesses from home, and if they are running businesses from home, to make sure that they're registered, and if they're not registered, then to shut them down? That's a municipal function. Just because we've got defunct municipalities in many, many parts of the country doesn't make it the Tourism Business Council or the Department of Tourism's business to go messing in private enterprise, does it?
Bruce, I tend to agree with that. I mean, I think, you know, the restrictions are probably already there. I mean, a lot of what SA Tourism has said around this is, you know, we don't want to be caught out like Uber, you know, and not have anybody that can regulate Airbnb. And certainly around the globe, many countries and jurisdictions have gone to regulating what happens with Airbnb in terms of either the number of days that someone can let out their dwelling, you know, whether someone's there or not there. But of course, there are far more effective systems in terms of registration, monitoring, enforcement in those jurisdictions. And in South Africa, you know, getting people to register in the first place, I think it might be challenging. And it's interesting because these amendments almost contradict the intentions of the Tourism Bill or the Tourism Act, which one of them is about giving access to tourism to the local community, to the host communities. And that is something that these platforms really does, in the sense that
good point.
It gives people a chance to run a small business where, you know, they wouldn't otherwise. And in an economy where jobs are scarce, where we're trying to encourage people to start small businesses, you know, we should be looking for more pro-business regulation. But at the same time, one can completely empathize with where the sector is coming from. But from a competition perspective and a free market perspective, which is not really where we are in competition legislation currently, is really what should happen is that the market should adapt and should compete, and the consumers will make decisions with their feet and their credit cards.
Rather than tell somebody that they can't stay in a place for a certain amount of time longer than X, tell them why they should be staying in a place because of the Wi-Fi and everything, every benefit that a hotel brings, the security, whatever. Sell yourselves harder. Roz, thank you. Rosalind Dake is director at Norton Rose, and to Chifiwa Chivengwa, who is the chief executive of the Tourism Business Council of South Africa. Interesting, with many of his members being parts of the hotel industry, he's got to fight their corner. And and he makes some compelling arguments. If you've built a 100-room hotel, you want people to come and stay in those hotels. And occupancy rates in South African hotels are low, but it's not just because of Airbnb. So not the visa stuff. So it makes South Africa a safer place to come to. All of those good things. And hotels, we won't have enough hotel rooms. And then you'll be desperate for the private sector to come in and rent out rooms and hotels. I mean, it's been happening for centuries, for goodness sake. Airbnb just found a mechanism to make it safer, to rate it, to find a way for people to trust the B&B sector. That's genius, frankly.
The Money Show. The Markets.
Arthur Karras with the Old Mutual Investment Group. This regulatory issue is such an interesting one. Just Neo on the SMS line saying that, you know, these Airbnbs aren't treated as business. Rates and taxes, not in safety and regulations, commercial banking, they're competing unfairly. I didn't care until I heard this argument. So certainly the debate seems to be, and there are lots of other comments similar to this, that maybe the hotel sector's got a point when it comes to this issue of regulation.
Well, hotels, like any business, in like a lot of businesses in various sectors, have to jump through a whole lot of hoops before they can open up their doors. What Airbnb allows you to do potentially is to compete with a hotel business without meeting any of those regulations, in fact, without even registering as a business. So you do need to be fair that in terms of how you apply regulation. If you want to protect consumers, you need to protect them at multiple levels.
But consumers also have got choice. We're grown-ups. We can choose our own platforms. I mean, as a family, we haven't used Airbnb because we're skeptical. I mean, that's not, you know, it's a personal choice. We choose other forms of accommodation. Many other people swear by the Airbnb concept, will use only it because they have a far more satisfying experience. They go to areas where they might otherwise not go. They just have the choice. But yes, I get the competition issue, but at the same time, it's quite disheartening that a sector with lots of firepower within an industry can get regulation at the cost of small guys trying to start up their own businesses. But I get it. I do get it. Talk about regulation. MultiChoice is, you know, it's the dominant player in satellite TV across the African continent. Competitors have tried and failed, and some still continue to knock on the door. But they've got that market well tied down, and the Competition Commission doesn't like it.
They've got that market tied down because they've got a lock on the things that consumers of TV entertainment want, which is Hollywood movies and world-class sports. And there isn't, it just isn't anybody else around that can afford to pay for those in South Africa. Those are not cheap things to secure, and that's given them a lock on it. The things that they're suggesting in terms of limiting the number of studios that MultiChoice can contract with begs the question of who's got the pockets to pay for these movies.
It's so interesting because ultimately then consumers will pay more, because if you say that MultiChoice can only have a certain number of channels, and I happen to like all of the MultiChoice channels, then two of the competitors come on board and pick up the channels that MultiChoice no longer wants, and I'm going to have two other service providers so that I can have all the programs I'm used to from one channel. Again, you're opening up the market, but are consumers better off? Not necessarily.
I think it's going to continue to go in that direction. I think you're all going to have a number of icons on your set-top box, and you're going to click on that, whether it's Netflix or Amazon or Showmax, and you will have to, I think, split your split your entertainment spending between a number of different providers. If you're going to want to watch all the shows, you can.
Yeah. And what are we going to do with all our spare time, I wonder? Naspers, of course, which unbundled MultiChoice and is now in the process of, it talks about adding value to investors by the split, where it takes its international internet assets and puts them on the Euronext exchange in Amsterdam and then leaves the rest in South Africa. And then South Africa owns 75% of that business. Some skepticism as to whether or not this is going to be the magic that is required.
It's quite a complex deal, and there was one of the concerns that you have is you will now end up with another pyramid, in effect, for those of us that can remember pyramid holding companies in South Africa.
As opposed to a pyramid scheme, a pyramid holding company.
Yes, a pyramid holding company. Yeah. So you'll have a company in South Africa that will own, for the most part, a company listed in Amsterdam, which for the most part will own a company listed in Hong Kong. So you could, in fact, argue that it's getting more complicated and you could have more discounts piled on top of one another. It doesn't really change the structure of what you own. You continue to own the same thing. So it seems difficult to imagine that the valuation will improve. You could attract more investors into the company, which will relieve the problem that you currently have, and that South Africans are struggling to own more Naspers. But whether it's going to affect the valuation in the long term remains to be seen.
Okay. And then finally, I mean, Venezuela, you've been doing some work on Venezuela, and it's a bit like Zimbabwe at the height of its currency crisis. If you had Zimbabwe dollars, you were a quadrillionaire if you were invested on the Zim Stock Exchange. I suppose Venezuelans have been pretty much in the same sort of boat.
Well, at our Macro Solutions Weekly meeting today, we were discussing the impact of currency on long-term equity returns. And we thought about what is the impact of hyperinflation on currencies, on markets. And this afternoon, I happened to notice that Venezuela is up 500% year to date and some 400,000% over the last 5 years. Regrettably, for Venezuelan market investors, that's in the local currency.
The Bolivar, yeah.
In dollars, down 96%.
Yeah, and that's the reality. I mean, when economies break, so do markets. And if you look at your value in terms of global value, you've got to measure it in the dollar. And South Africa is positive in dollar terms for the year. We don't want to be down 96% in dollar terms. You're not doing anything. You're not going anywhere at that rate.
Absolutely not. I think we all like to measure our returns in dollars. It is, however, important as South African investors to remember that many of our future obligations that we're saving for are measured in rands.
Most certainly are. Arthur Karras with the Old Mutual Investment Group, thank you very much. Time for the biz quiz, of course, the fast fact question with Altron. And we have got 3,000 rand in cash. 3,000 rand in cash. I didn't know it was so much. I'm surprised by this. Mubin, I need to know an answer from you, please. And the question in today's fast fact was one, which is, who is advising that they rebrand the 737 MAX aircraft? What is the answer, Mubin?
Hi there, Bruce. It's Donald Trump.
Would you like 3,000 rand, Mubin?
That would be nice. Thank you.
We'll get it to you. We'll get it to you, Mubin. Well done to you. Mubin is the winner of the first of this edition of The Fast Fact. American Airlines has said it's going to extend its ban on flying the Boeing 737 MAX 8 flights from June until mid-August, so delaying their return to the skies to provide confidence to consumers. There have been two high-profile crashes of this aircraft over the last 6 months or so, the most recent one in Ethiopia. Comair has grounded its one 737-8 MAX and has suspended the delivery of the rest of the fleet until it's got clarity. And President Trump tweeting, "What do I know about branding? Maybe nothing, but I did become the president!" Exclamation mark. But if I were Boeing, I would fix the Boeing 737 MAX, add some great additional features, and rebrand the plane with a new name. Free advice from the President of the United States.
The Money Show is brought to you by NetBank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. NetBank.
Coming up on your next Money Show, I've got Jared Molko in studio for How It Works. Artificial intelligence. Everybody's talking about it. Everybody's petrified of it. Some people are saying it's going to be a help to human beings in the future. Others warn that it's going to take over your job, take over the world, and everybody, human beings, will be sitting and be completely deficient and defunct. Well, Jared's recently returned to South Africa after 7 years at Google. He's on a crusade to raise awareness on the challenges we all face on automation and AI. Plus, Andy Rice with this week's Advertising Heroes and Zeros, and all the other big money stories of the day.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live, online, smartphones, DSTV, and 92.7 and 106 FM.
So who is Jumia? What is Jumia? This is a company that has leapt into the public eye since its listing on the New York Stock Exchange on NASDAQ on Friday afternoon. It rallied very, very strongly, and it's terribly good news for one South African company. That South African company is MTN, which owns a 30% stake in what they call the Amazon of Africa. Craig Wilson is the editor of Stuff magazine. Tell me, Craig Wilson, about Jumia.
Sure. Well, Bruce, Jumia operates in 14 countries doing e-commerce, amongst other things. They also do food delivery of the sorts we've been familiar with Uber Eats. They have an online marketplace for things like jobs. But what's particularly interesting, as you mentioned in your intro, is that they are now listed on the New York Stock Exchange. And so far, at least, it's been a pretty good start. The share climbed 75% on its first day, and it hasn't fallen back very much from there. It's sitting, last I looked, it's almost $28. It opened at about 14 and a half, I think. And so the thing to bear in mind with Jumia, though, lots of people are calling this the Amazon of Africa, but it doesn't face a lot of the challenges that Amazon has faced. So one of the things it's had to do is to roll out a lot of its own infrastructure for the delivery part of the sort of e-commerce business, because as we know all too well here in South Africa, you can't just build one of these businesses and rely on the post office. Well, you can if you don't want to have too many very happy customers. So they've had to roll out their own sort of last mile delivery service. The upshot of this, of course, is that they are creating all sorts of other smaller businesses along the way.
Do they own those businesses, or are they doing this with an entrepreneurial mindset, sort of creating their own supply chains, if you like?
They seem to own the vast majority of them, in part because a lot of them just don't exist. Another challenge that brings you to that you made me think of is that they also can't always just accept card payments. So that, of course, comes with all sorts of risks and costs of its own, that they do a lot of cash on delivery business. And, you know, we've seen this too from the likes of Uber. It's rolled out in other countries in Africa and then had to offer cash rather than doing the usual card services that it does in other markets. And this, of course, is costly and risky. So like Uber, which, you know, is a good example, I think, of another one of these sort of tech startups that's come into Africa and done rather well, as opposed to being built largely in Africa, is that it is, by all accounts, still massively loss-making. But I guess the appeal, particularly for investors, the appeal is twofold. The first is that it has had massive investment. You know, it has been touted in a lot of the press as Africa's first real tech unicorn. But the other one is that, as with Uber, there is a real, the perception at least, that there is a real land grab opportunity. You know, the suggestion is that if Jumia can stay the course and if investors are willing to play the long game, it could get a sizable first mover advantage.
I mean, it is a company, it's grown organically on this continent. It is fully, it understands the challenges of running the businesses, the challenges of setting up the supply chains, the networks, the delivery mechanisms, everything from scratch, simply because it's operated in this environment from the beginning. And therefore, with that first mover advantage and the creating the networks, it could be the dominant player into the future.
We have to hope so. Of course, there was a rival service called Conga that didn't fare quite so well and was sold at what's reputed to be quite a loss. And, you know, the challenge is really, can it stick it out? You know, all the funding in the world is all good and well, but what I think the biggest challenge facing it is, can it change consumer perception? Because, you know, as we mentioned, in terms of the wanting to pay cash, there is still a trust issue when it comes to online purchases. And the other challenge is going to be after sales. You know, we have come to expect from other big retailers, and we've seen it in South Africa done very successfully by the likes of Takealot, that what you need to do is have really, really solid return policies. And you need to get to the point where people are happy to buy all sorts of things online without touching and feeling them. And this includes things like clothing. You know, one of the great challenges I know for a lot of South African consumers, even middle-class ones, myself included, was in the early days, I didn't want to buy clothing online because I didn't want to have to deal with the hassle of returning it. And, you know, now a lot of these companies, we've had a lot of mergers locally. You know, I have no such concerns anymore. In fact, sometimes, and much to their dismay, I'm sure, I'll just order two sizes, right? Because I know that I can send the one that doesn't fit back. And that shifted my trust in using these sorts of services. And I think that is in many ways going to be the greatest challenge. Is you've got to get people willing to use these services, and you've got to get them willing to do it to the point that they will come back time and again and not just use your service as a means of comparing price before they go and buy the product somewhere else from a bricks and mortar retailer.
And then, of course, this is the big question, I suppose, is Jumia MTN's Tencent? I mean, they'd love it to be, but has it got the potential to do what Tencent did to Naspers?
Look, I mean, they're certainly saying that it does. They're certainly very optimistic that it does. I guess the other thing to watch is how well they're able to spread into other markets. And there is certainly going to be some, I think, a little nervousness given MTN's history in Nigeria. You know, one of the worries when it is a Nigerian-owned company is that there is this risk of political instability, and not necessarily in the country itself, but in terms of, you know, MTN has had a very hard time with the Nigerian regulators. It's had to pay all sorts of, you know, enormous fines and things. And I think for investors, that certainly remains a concern. Is this going to still be a great place to do business in 5 years? And is it going to be insulated from any other sort of whims of regulators or other bodies that are particularly tough to control? You know, Naspers, for example, has twice withdrawn from the Kenyan market after having a go there. And so, you know, we're going to have to give it a little, a few years to see whether this plays out. I think this is very, very much a long-term and long-game sort of play. And I would be a little wary of, you know, looking for fast returns. Although, of course, I say that if you bought shares on Friday, sold them on Monday, you would have turned a tidy profit. So perhaps I need to be a little more, have more of an appetite for risk.
That's why you're in journalism, along with me. Craig Wilson, thank you. The editor of Stuff magazine on The Money Show.
The Money Show. Stock Pick Monday.
Stock Pick Monday, we like to have a look at a couple of shares that you might want to include in an investment portfolio, but do buyer beware is our only warning. That's all we can say to you. The buyer beware issue is a big one because stock markets are inherently unpredictable and difficult to read. Over time, people make money in markets, but individual stocks are always, you know, a little bit more challenging. And that's why we get experts in. One of those is Nadir Tokand, who is investment analyst at 27Four Asset Management. And Nadir, nice to have you back on The Money Show. MultiChoice is your first pick this evening. I mean, on the day that they announce that the Competition Commission announces that it's not happy with the dominance of MultiChoice in the entertainment sector, you go, ooh, this is a good day to buy some shares. Why?
Evening, Bruce, and good evening to your listeners. It's actually quite an interesting example of a stock which people overestimate to be in a sunset industry. You know, it's very trendy to sit around very trendy restaurants in Sandton and talk about how we're all cancelling our DSTV subscriptions and buying our Netflix subscriptions because it's, one-sixth of the cost, or getting, to subscribe to things like Hulu and Amazon Prime. But the reality of the situation is that, this is a stock which generates a phenomenal amount of cash. Let's not forget that it came out of the Naspers stable, and typically the cash flow from MultiChoice is what funded a lot of the acquisitions of the likes of Tencent and Mail.ru and Flipkart. So if you break down the numbers, this is a company which generates something like, just above ₹9.5 billion in net profitability. And if you exclude the African business, which actually runs at a loss, it generates about 8.1 or 8.2 billion rand in profitability, or rather, including the African business, it generates 8.1, and just the SA business alone generates 9.5. So the African business is loss-making. If you can get that to break even, that's about 9 rand in the share price. And we think that people massively overestimate the attrition of users within the satellite TV space. Research internationally shows that the OTT or the over-the-top content producers, people have those in addition to their pay TV subscriptions. And also, this is a company which is sitting on a phenomenal amount of cash, about 4.2 billion rand in net cash. And we know that it's not paying a dividend this year because they're investing to get Africa to break even. But once dividends resumes, we know that that's been a very attractive source of income for the Putuma Nati shareholders, and likely to be for the MultiChoice shareholders for many years to come. So I think a business which people overestimate the sunset industry, only about 12% of South Africans are going to have access to high-speed fiber internet within the next 5 years, and you require a high-speed fiber internet line in order to cancel the DStv to get the rest of them, notwithstanding the fact that they still have the sports rights, which are phenomenally valuable.
I get that, but what about the Competition Commission, which is saying, hold on a second, we don't like your dominance. We want you to have a restricted number of Hollywood studios that you can buy movies from. We want restricted sports from you. We want to open up this market to competition.
Yeah. Look, I mean, the bottom line is that this market hasn't been closed to competition. You know, if you think about Talk TV, which tried to operate here a number of years ago, they just haven't been able to overcome the dominance of the multi-choice model and the fact that they have sporting rights signed for many years to come. And, you know, when those sporting rights come up for negotiation, sure, there's going to be more competition coming in. You know, but those are still a number of years away. And the bottom line is that the regulator can say we don't like the dominance, but there's got to be operators which are willing to come here in order to compete with Naspers. And the competitors who have tried to come here haven't been able to do so. And that's why we see, especially in the OTT space, it's very fragmented. You know, Netflix has part of the market, Amazon Prime has another, Hulu has another, and it's a very fragmented market. So the bottom line is that, you know, they produce stuff that people watch. You know, local content is probably about 12% of what they produce, but 26% of what people watch. And the foreign OTT providers are not willing to spend that amount on local content. So the regulator can come out and say all they want to about more competition. The bottom line is that the competitors are going to need to be willing to come here, invest the capital, and only see the returns in many years to come. And it's unlikely that in this sort of investment environment, at 1% economic growth, we're going to get a significant amount of investors that are willing to lay out that kind of capital expenditure.
That's a compelling argument. What about Pick and Pay?
Yeah, so I think this is the quintessential turnaround story. You know, ShopRite has been the darling of the market for many, many years. And, you know, they've been market leading in terms of investing in their DC centers, maintaining the highest margins in the food retail space at around about a 5% margin. And Pick and Pay obviously lags significantly behind that. You know, I mean, to give you a kind of example of the kind of battles Pick and Pay had, if you try to order milk from an online Pick and Pay store a couple of years ago, they literally ran out of stock. That was how badly their stock maintenance and their stock distribution from their DC centers are happening. They've invested a significant amount in those DC centers. We see the turnaround story gaining hold. You know, they're coming off a low base in terms of their PE multiple. We know that, you know, they're working towards getting to that ShopRite margin, currently on around about a 2.5% operating margin. So, you know, and working north from that point, getting to around a 3.5% margin possibly over the next 2 years, and working towards getting to that ShopRite 5% margin. I think that, you know, they're obviously gaining a lot of market share from their competitors. If you look at their most recent trading up, which they in fact issued just about a week ago, in the 12 months to the end of March, they're looking to have grown their South African revenues by just a smidgen above 7%, their overall revenues by 5%. Reporting like-for-like growth of 5%. That's obviously, you know, doesn't sound all that impressive, but when you consider the ShopRite numbers and the fact that they only grew, you know, revenues by 2.5% in SA last year, it gives you an indication of the kind of market share they're gaining from their competitors. Granted, it's coming at a price in terms of their internal inflation. In fact, they had deflation for the last 12 months of minus 0.3% in terms of the cost of their basket coming down, but it's definitely paying off in terms of gaining customers. And with debt restructuring and paying down a significant amount of their debt, to give you an indication, you know, you're getting 6% top-line revenue growth, but that's translating into north of 20% earnings growth because the kind of operational efficiencies you've gotten, paying down a heck of a lot of their debt and reducing their interest servicing bill, and that's translating into significantly better earnings growth. So the tough decisions that the company took, you know, 2 to 3 years ago, really starting to see dividends from that coming through and gaining market share from a lot of their competitors. And as I mentioned, you know, you're not paying a heck of a lot in terms of the multiple for this, because it's always kind of been the ugly stepchild of the food retail industry when compared to the likes of ShopRite or even Spar for that matter.
Nadir Token, thank you. The investment analyst at 27.4. Two picks for you this evening. Multi-choice, despite the competition issues, he likes it very much. And Pick and Pay, the ugly stepchild of the retail sector. After Eyewitness News, we got our business book of the week. I want to introduce you to an interesting business that deals with deceased pets and how Stats SA's developed a sense of humor.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Lots to come in the next hour of The Money Show. Neil Froneman, the chief executive at Sibanye-Stillwater. I'll Make Money Monday's personal edition guest. I'm really interested to hear his perspectives on money this evening. I've got Ian Mann, Mr. Business Books, who has got a book this evening about learning to think in systems. Sounds like a page-turner, but Ian makes them always interesting. He does. An author called Albert Rutherford, who I think is good at these things, writing these books. And then in a moment, a man called Brian Scott, who is the chief executive of business. Essentially an animal undertaker. I can't think of any better way of describing it than that. So we'll talk to him in just a bit. But first, a little bit of a sense of humour coming out of Stats SA. Now, I confessed earlier to not ever having used Airbnb. I'm going to confess something else this evening, which will either raise your estimation. No, well, that's not hard. In many of you, if you had any sense of estimation, it'll denigrate that estimation, that sense of high esteem even more. Because I haven't ever watched an episode, well, not a whole one, I once tried, of Game of Thrones. And the world's going mad for Game of Thrones. People are so excited. It's season 8. And people are waking up early in the morning to watch Game of Thrones. People are obsessed. Well, what Stats SA has done is they've created a little inflation basket of how much things have gone up since the first season of Game of Thrones, which I thought was very innovative of Stats SA. So well done to you, Stats SA. It really is very good. On average, the price of a TV has gone up 43.5% since April 2011 when Game of Thrones was first aired. The price of a box of tissues, so because you shed lots of tears apparently because lots of people die. Famous people die. So you get attached to a main character. You think, well, nobody in the movies ever dies. Main characters don't die generally. And Game of Thrones, that kills off a main character every episode, apparently. That's what they do. And you get attached to them and then they die. And so a box of tissues is up 13%. What's interesting is decoders are at their cheapest levels since Game of Thrones started. So decoders are nearly 20% cheaper today than they were in 2011 in rand terms. That's an interesting fact. Apparently, you need lots of wine to help you through Game of Thrones, and the average price of wine is up 36. And if you want a blanket to keep warm, because winter is coming, because that's a line from the series, a blanket will cost you 17.3% more than it did in April 2011. So Stats SA, well done to you for having a sense of humour and a sense of timing. They don't have prices for crowns, for axes, for swords or for castles, however, because they don't feature in the South African inflation basket. Stats SA, sense of humour, 10 points.
Bruce Whitfield on 702.
The Money Show, brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank. Well, I was driving in Cape Town the other day and I saw an interesting looking vehicle and it appealed to my macabre sense of curiosity. It was a van bearing a logo, R.I. Pets. So clever play on R.I.P., but R.I. Pets. I got my producers to do a little investigation and they found Brian Scott, the chief executive of R.I. Pets, on the line to us from Cape Town this evening. I mean, Brian, having grown up on a farm and not ever having had urban pets, it's not ever something I ever considered about dealing with the remains of, in many cases, people's best friend, the pet in the family. When pets die, it's a big thing. What sparked the idea of a business to deal with pet remains?
Well, I think it's very similar to what some people do with the cremated remains of a loved one. They want to have something to remember the pet by, and so they'd like the ashes back. And we do that. We cremate the pet of whatever type it is and return the ashes to them in a little urn with the name on it and hand painted, and then they've got something to keep on the mantelpiece to remind them of their loved one.
I mean, and what sparked the idea, though? What was the what gave you the idea that you should be the guy to become the animal undertaker?
I think possibly there were a number of reasons. Municipalities started to say that there were bylaws about not burying pets in gardens. Also, if you think about many people rent a home and the owner might not be too happy with you burying animals in their premises. Plus the fact that when an animal is euthanized, there are chemicals in the body which would seep into the groundwater, and that's not exactly desirable. that, plus if the animal had any disease. So it is safer and more hygienic and perhaps even more humane to dispose of the body in an organized fashion. And that's where we saw the need and formed the business just over 20 years ago.
20 years ago. I mean, anyone familiar with the work of Stephen King is familiar with the dreadful book Pet Cemetery, because cities generally don't have pet cemeteries anymore. I think there are places in the US, maybe in the UK, where there are pet cemeteries and people have a little plot of ground and can go and visit their pet. But I don't think we have that here, do we?
Quite right. If there is, I certainly don't know about it. There are what we call communal burial sites, which are approved by the city, in this case the city of Cape Town, and I'm sure there are in other cities as well, but they're not particularly pet cemeteries because you're not able to go and visit them and show respect or think about your pet, so that unfortunately isn't available.
For many families, the loss of a pet is very, very real. I mean, it's the first loss that a child suffers. This can be a deeply traumatic event, and you are dealing with bereavement in a very real way when you're dealing with the loss of an animal. I mean, that's a critical part, no doubt, of what you're providing, which in suburbia is an essential service.
Absolutely. In fact, as we say on our website, we provide a compassionate, ethical and dignified service. Because we realize exactly what it is that pet owners go through. And most of us involved in the business are pet owners ourselves and possibly have had the experience. So we certainly identify with the person who's now going through the same experience.
And is it a thriving business? I mean, everything from, I suppose, budgies to hamsters to dogs and cats and more exotic pets that people suddenly discover they have to get rid of.
Yes, that's quite true. It is. I wouldn't say exactly thriving in that probably a growing business. People are keeping more and more unusual pets like lizards and Komodo dragon type things, snakes, hamsters, guinea pigs, you name it. But by far the most common, of course, are the dogs and cats. But we also have a number of birds, parrots, budgies, and so on, and they can all be cremated, and we treat them in the same way. People have just as much concern for them as they do for other types of pets, so we don't discriminate.
Do you need a special license to operate an incinerator? I mean, where do you even buy an incinerator, for goodness sake?
Well, yes, you certainly do. It's one of the most regulated industries in the country. You certainly can't just start burning them in your backyard. You do have to get a license and have to do an environmental study in order to get that. But we were fortunate in being able to buy an incinerator that had already existed that was in use with the government at the time.
I mean, a government incinerator, it sounds a little bit macabre. Tell us, has it got a backstory?
Yes, it was actually the incinerator that was used when Chris Barnard was doing all the experiments on the baboons at the time, before the first heart transplant. And sadly, some of them would die, and then they would have to be disposed of. And they built an incinerator out in the Delft area. And then that fell into disuse when the research was discontinued at the time. And then the Medical Research Council bought the land and decided that a commercial enterprise could probably be interested in the incinerator, and that was us. So we bought it, and we've been operating ever since.
Does it work on electricity? I mean, because that's a business risk, I would assume.
Actually, good point. It actually works on paraffin.
Oh.
We're fortunate there, otherwise we would have a problem. And there are various options for the incinerators. You can run them on gas, paraffin, diesel, or electricity. We chose paraffin because at the time it was relatively inexpensive. It has changed since then, but still less than electricity.
So Tony from Benoni tells me that at Kar Vader's Kraal near Hermanus, there's a pet cemetery. A settler of 120 years ago buried her horses there, and it's a national monument today. I mean, the weird things that our listeners know about. And Brian, it's a really interesting story, and I thank you for sharing it with us. I mean, when you look at this, I mean, people are very attached to animals. People are... Very. I mean, how many pickups a day do you do? One doesn't want to be busy in the undertaking trade, but I bet you are.
Yes. We do on total in a month, average month, about 1,400, sure. Of which just under half are where the owner requires the ashes back. If they don't want the individual cremation, which of course costs a little more than the standard cremation, where we cremate a number of animals together, and then there's no return of the ashes. And then the final option is a communal burial, as I say, at a licensed burial site, and that, of course, costs the least amount of money, and the option is up to the owner.
And I suppose vets would use you as well, simply because they won't have their own facility. That's not their business.
Very much so. In fact, we probably call on nearly all the vets in the Western Cape, and they do certainly provide a service whereby often people will take the animal there and ask for it to be euthanized and then taken from there onwards through to us. We will then come and collect them from the vet. But for people who have the traumatic experience of getting a death at home, they don't even want to take it to a vet. They then call on us and we come around and collect it ourselves.
It's a macabre. I mean, thank you, Brian. I mean, Brian Scott provides a very, very valuable service, and I feel quite unsettled. I really do. I've never had to consider it because I haven't had a pet in a long time. But this chief executive of RI Pets and just drove past this vehicle while in Cape Town and went, "That's interesting. Must talk to them." And we did. Brian Scott, who helps families get over the bereavement of the loss of a pet. And in many cases, people are deeply, deeply, deeply attached to their animals. And you've got to have a way for a family to deal with that loss. Interesting one. Thank you, Brian Scott.
The Money Show. Business Books.
Ian Mann is our business book review guy who joins us on occasional Mondays to come and share with us his deep insights into his extraordinary library of books, which he probably has more books than my friend David Shapiro, the stockbroker, has ties. He has more than 250 ties and more cupboard space at home than his wife. I bet you have more business books than that.
Many more than that,
you
yes.
see? Show off. There's competition. this book doesn't sound like a book I would, unless I was had insomnia, that yes. I would take to bed with me. It's called Learn to Think in Systems. I've only one system. It's called a pillow by somebody called Albert Rutherford. But it strikes me as a deeply useful book.
It is deeply useful, and I'll tell you why. You see, we are faced with problems that never get solved in our businesses, in our personal lives, in the country. We have the same problem again and again,
and we keep trying to solve them in the same old way,
in exactly the same old way. And there's a lot of reasons why our brains seem to evolve that we are in a perpetual state of the present, and we just seem to live in the present. Now's good, or now's bad, or now's this, or now I've got to fix this up. And with our frontal lobes having developed quite a bit, we're supposed to be able to think way beyond that. But I think that we'll use those frontal lobes for dealing with problems a lot better if we have some system to deal with it with, and some way of approaching how to deal with systems. So I think that that's where this book really has value. Many of our daily problems are very simple. If the phone is dead, plug it in.
Is that what you have to do? That's
what you're supposed to do. Yes, in fact. And then you've got... You're thirsty, so go and drink something. So if this, then that. And we apply the if this, then that to almost every problem that we have around us.
Because our instinct is solve this problem.
Right now.
Solve this problem now, because otherwise it becomes a bigger problem.
Yes, and it's too complicated, so we won't do that. So we've got problems which we solve, and they should be solved, if this, then that. But we apply that thinking to problems that should not be solved like that because they're complex. Obviously, there are problems which are so complex you really need a highly skilled person in that small discipline to be able to do it well. But there's lots of everyday problems that we should be thinking more systemically about. And I think that his introduction to thinking systemically is what's so valuable about this book. So let me just give you an example he uses for a simple example. He says, my grandparents lived in a village. And literally every spring, when the snow on the mountains melted, the river, there was a strong flowing river near the village, would flood the village. And then people get into action and clear it up and fix it and wait till next spring when it happened again. Now, that's an event. It flooded. When you have an event that seems to recur, it's worthwhile looking at the pattern behind it. So when you look at the pattern behind it, you say it's got to do with the melting snow. Now we see that there's a system that's causing them to flood, and now we have to get the group together and say we need to deal with this by building up the embankments during these months, because that's when it does seem to, and when those months are gone, we take them down and enjoy the river. But it's getting people to think systemically about things as opposed to just thinking if this, then that.
How do we then adapt running our businesses or running our lives to that kind of very practical thinking? Because that's a real world example.
Indeed.
And we can see the problem, we can see the solution, it makes sense perfectly.
Yes.
But often when we're mired in the complexity of dealing with the day-to-day crises, that we're so busy with buckets of water putting out fires, that we can't think like that.
I think that it's not that we can't, it's that we don't.
We won't.
And what he does, he identifies eight archetypes of systems. I just want to share with you four, so you
sure
get the idea of what he's talking about. For example, he says, there's if we don't see the systems, we limit our choices. So take this one, for example. We have one of these archetypes of fixes that backfire. Now, there are lots of fixes that we have. I fixed the problem. It's out the way. It's done. You have a stomachache, and it's quite painful, and it seems to be happened a couple of times. You get tablets.
Nothing that a Panado 2 can't sort out.
Nothing that a Panado 2 can't sort out until it doesn't sort it out, and you realize that that the damage done to your stomach is so bad now can't be repaired.
Now there's an ulcer.
Now there's
cancer.
So
yes.
The thing is that we often find fixes that backfire because we didn't put the proper fix in place. This happens absolutely everywhere. And painkillers would be a good example of short-term thinking. We also have this idea that success is always good. I will never have too many clients. Don't worry. Just hit me with your best. Come to buy as much as you can. Well, there is a limit to success, and success is not always good. Because as you get so successful and your demand goes through the roof, you can't supply them. And now a lot of people all know that your service is appalling and don't deal with you. So even when you get to success, you say, well, success is a system. As it grows, as the demand grows, my service has to be appropriate to the demand that's growing.
Yeah.
And if I don't get that system right, I will fail. That's a limit to success. Then we have another one that he talks about is the tragedy of the commons. The commons are those sorts of things like grazing land or a river or forests or water. And you say, well, it's there for the common good. And because it's available for all of us, it tends to get exploited and depleted rather fast.
Yeah.
And it's the thing with this is that we if we can see the commons, we've got to heighten awareness of the fact that the commons don't last forever, and they won't be a common good if they don't last forever. So we need to heighten people's awareness. We understand the system. We need to heighten people's awareness about the necessity of quotas and the necessity of regulations. If we don't take that into account in advance, you find polluted air, polluted rivers, and exploitation. There's also other things. I'll just give one more. We have this idea that if you work really hard, you'll be successful. Well, it's not really true. Just consider this one. An Olympic gold medalist, as soon as you get the gold medal, you're open to getting more sponsorships. Because you've got more sponsorships, you get better training, better equipment, better opportunities. The guy who's after you, as good as he is, will never be able to beat you because you got there first. And you got the gold medal first, so you have the opportunities. So often success leads to success. And these sort of, when we start thinking like this, we realize how interconnected things actually are. And they're not as simple as we thought they might be. Just to add one more layer to this, all of these things have a mindset behind them. For example, when we talk about the backfiring, we have this propensity to think short term. The problem is gone, that's good. Yes, but that's why the ulcer or the cancer developed.
Yes, exactly.
And the limits to success, well, success is all, our mindset is success is always a good. No, it's not always a good. And then you think of, I better get my share of the commons, because if I don't get my share, somebody else will get my share, and then I've lost out.
Yes.
So we all pile in to be sure we get our share, and then nobody eventually gets anybody's share. And then there's the other thing, well, if penguins could fly if they only tried hard enough, it doesn't... It doesn't actually work like that. The gold medalist got there first. And when we think in those sort of systems, I think that it can be incredibly helpful to changing the way we think. there is a part to his book which I can't explain on radio, only because it's graphic. One of the things that is very valuable when you start thinking like this, you can draw diagrams. And I found it enormously helpful to be able to show people the diagrams of the success. And if you touch this part, it will affect that part, which will cause the success to go away because you don't do that.
There's a consequence. For every action, there's a consequence. I mean, somebody sent me a clip of a video which I found inspiring and so demotivating and infuriating at the same time, because it was a very compelling speaker on some UK panel show criticizing growth. Yes. And growth for growth's sake, and the only way we work out our problems is by growing. And as we grow, we consume more. As we consume more, we need more energy. As we need more energy, we exploit the resources more. As we exploit the resources more, we undermine that commons. And ultimately, we are growing ourselves into oblivion in this mad pursuit of growth, because everybody needs to get richer and better off, and we need to raise the poorest in our communities. And the only way we know how to do that is to grow.
More exploitation.
And it strikes me that this book is similar to that idea by Albert Rutherford.
It is.
That we really need to rethink the way we operate before there is nothing left to exploit.
Indeed. Indeed. And the efforts that go in may well be efforts that lead to exactly the opposite of what we intended.
Ian Mann from Gateways Business Consultants runs his own business book club and has lots and lots of books on his shelf.
The Money Show is brought to you by NetBank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. NetBank. The Money Show. Make Money Mondays.
Make Money Mondays on a Monday evening. Neil Froneman, Chief Executive of Sibanye-Stillwater. It's good to have you in studio with us this evening, Neil Froneman. At the height of a strike, how are things progressing on the strike front for Neil Froneman?
Good evening, Bruce. We had an interesting juncture. We've got a very confident legal position. We still try and find a negotiated settlement, although at this stage that's quite difficult. My real concern is getting strikers back to work who haven't earned money for 5 months and then integrating them back into a normal life. So it's a tough time for all of us.
Strike action, 5 months. This is in the gold division of Sibanye-Stillwater. You started out life as Sibanye Gold. You emerged out of Goldfields, the South African assets of Goldfields, and you took on running this business of Sibanye, and then later on became Sibanye-Stillwater. It's at this stage just the gold division that's been on strike for these 5 months, right?
Yes, that's correct.
But roughly how many people have not been working?
Between 14 and 15,000, that's about half the number of employees in the gold division. It's one union's members.
This is AMCU and Joseph Mutundwe, yeah.
That is correct. The other three unions, NUM, UAS and Solidarity, they're at work, and they form about the other half.
And what does that do then to gold production within a company like Sibanye-Stillwater? You now have the offset of platinum group metals as a result of your investment in Stillwater in the United States, and that's proved to be something of a savior for you. I mean, your share price, despite the fact that half your gold division workers have been on strike for 5 months, is up, 50% over 6 months, over that same sort of period?
Yes, that's correct. Look, it's off a low base. I'm the first one to say that it's not a great performance. But in terms of gold, we are producing, well, let's say we've got strike plans that we would produce at about 40% of what we normally do. We've lost about 140,000, 150,000 ounces so far this quarter. We had a fire to complicate things, which resulted in gold production only being about 35% of normalized production based on a strike.
When you're losing 150,000 ounces of production, I mean, that's an extraordinary amount of gold. That's 150,000 Krugerrands of gold, just to give you, try and give you an image of that. I mean, does it make the fight over pay that worthwhile?
Obviously, before we, consider saying no, we do a lot of work in terms of what is the additional cost of the wages being asked for. And if you, in this case, if you sum it up, you're talking an additional 300 Rand over 32,000 people. Over a life of mine of about 15 years, that's many billions. Now, the strike is not cheap, and it's cost us about 1.6 billion rand to date. However, my view is that we are investing in the resetting of a relationship at all levels, not just with AMCU. So it is a well-considered decision. It's not a knee-jerk or an ego-based decision.
I mean, it's interesting because when somebody says you're denying me a 300 rand a month increase and you say this is somebody who's not earning very much money, and then you look like the bad guy, especially when somebody goes to the annual report of Sibanye-Stillwater and a page through now, and one looks at the executive and non-executive and the prescribed officer's remuneration, and there's a big gap between the CEO pay and the gold miner pay. I mean, that is something that I'm sure is used against you all the time, as your pay is publicly available information.
Yes, that is correct. It's something that I'm certainly very sensitive to. But I need to point out two things in terms of that comment. The one is executive remuneration is determined by a committee. It's not determined by the executive. And that is what it costs to get executives of the caliber that we've got. I think the other thing is that The wage gap is something that we are working on as quickly as we can in the industry. I can quote that Sibanye from 2013 has increased gold miners' wages by 65%. That's a huge increase, and it's starting to have impact on sustainability. But I think we arrived at a fair increase. We would not have had three of the four unions accept that increase if it was not fair. It was certainly above inflation, but we've got a lot more to do on wage gaps in business in general.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is that all executive pay and non-executive pay is disclosed as a matter of law. Do you think it's been helpful? When pay, I think it was about 10 years ago, when pay became mandatory to disclose executive pay, it was meant to be this great transparency, and everybody would see what people were being paid, and that would embarrass remuneration committees into paying CEOs less. And all it's led to is actually it's opened up the market, because now you can see what Nick Holland gets paid at Goldfields, and you can see what a guy at Barrick gets paid. You can see what guys in Australia and in Canada are being paid. And you can say to your remuneration committee, well, I know how to dig gold out of the ground, and I know how to do it effectively and cheaply, and this is the wage that these guys pay, and they kind of feel obliged to ensure that you're globally competitive.
I think you spot on, Bruce. It's led to a lot of unhappiness, because everyone's happy with their remuneration until they find out what their neighbour earns or their colleagues earn, and then, of course, they're unhappy. It's also when you have people that are not financially astute reading those numbers, they don't fully appreciate them in terms of a lot of that remuneration's at risk, and in 3 years you may get zero of your long term incentive. So it's not well understood. It's a very complex area. I think transparency is one thing, but it has led to a lot of unhappiness, and I'm not sure that it's really been useful.
Has that made your life as the CEO of a gold mining company, which employs 30,000 people, more difficult? Because I'm sure at every wage negotiation, that's precisely what's thrown straight back at you. You won't give my guys 300 rand a month more, but you last year got 35 million.
Yes, it's used and abused, I would say, in that 300 rand divided into what the entire executive earns means you can afford to pay 15 or 20 employees for a year, or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
So it does get abused. But people have certain skills, and you've got to recognize those skills, and you've got to remunerate them as such. They are mobile, and we try and explain that to the unions. We also try, as I say, and address the inequality gaps, but it's not something that's going to be sorted out overnight.
No, most certainly not. I mean, somebody like Ketso Gordon, for example, tried at a PPC where he got his ex-co to cut their wages to make a small salary sacrifice relative to what it was they were earning, and then distribute that salary sacrifice amongst lower-paying workers. The lower-paying workers loved it. I don't think the ex-co was that thrilled.
No, look, last year we had a tough year. We could actually see some of it coming, And senior management, not just Exco, actually had no wage increase. You know, a year later when we award a 4.5% increase to show that we're responsible, there was a lot of unhappiness that we didn't make up what we hadn't got last year. So you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
Neil Frohneman, Chief Executive at Sibanye-Stillwater. That's the newsy part of the discussion. But I don't know anything about where Neil Frohneman grew up. I don't know anything about whether he's got mining in his blood. Did he grow up on a mine? It was, all of that sort of stuff. We'll find out about that. What informs his attitude towards money and how did he grow up with money? We'll pick up on that in just a moment.
The Money Show. Make Money Mondays.
Neil Frohneman, Chief Executive of Sibanye-Stillwater. We were talking about the strike which has been ongoing at the gold division of Sibanye-Stillwater for the last 5 months or so. Some 15,000 AMCU members out of a staff complement of 30,000 or so have been on strike for 5 months. And that, of course, has a detrimental impact on the livelihoods of people who do go on strike. But this is the part where we start asking you where you grew up and the sort of money mom and dad earned and try and get a sense of how your mind works around money, Neil Frohneman, your own money. And where did you grow up?
I grew up in Northcliffe in Johannesburg, so I'm local to Johannesburg.
Northcliffe, what did mom and dad do?
My dad was a company secretary who late in life decided to study again, and he went back to university and eventually became a chartered accountant. My mom was a hairdresser, so a really fairly simple family life.
Fairly simple in Northcliffe. I mean, it's a nice part of town. Did you get some good schooling as a result of growing up in Northcliffe?
Yes. Look, I was actually I grew up until about 4 or 5 years old in Hillbrow, so that puts it a bit in.
That was a fun part of town. And, I mean, it's always a fun part of town, but in those days, it was quite cosmopolitan, I suppose. I mean, we're talking in the 1960s, you were growing up in Hillbrow.
Yes, and it was a very different Hillbrow to today. But I did, and all credit to my parents, I did get a good education. I went to a very good school, Northcliffe High School. We were the fourth lot of matrix. I was part of the group that even planted the grass on the playing field. So very early days of Northcliffe High, but I am very privileged to say I got a good schooling at a government school.
Yeah, and we wish more people could say that. Did your parents stress about money? I mean, mom and dad were professionals. They had good occupations, but company secretaries don't earn big fortunes of money, do they?
No, and in the middle of my sort of school career, my dad went back to university. He became an auditor, and it was actually a fairly tough time for us. I remember my sister and myself couldn't go to the movies because we didn't have money. So money was not plentiful, but if I look at some of the poverty today, we were much better off than that. But it was still tough times.
Mm. I mean, did they stress about money, your parents? Or your dad clearly was ambitious, he had a goal, and was willing to make some sacrifices. I mean, that informs quite a lot in a young mind when you watch parents making sacrifices to make things better.
Absolutely. Both of them came from poor families, so they did stress about money. My mom worked from home. She used to count every cent from cutting hair. So they did stress a lot about money, my mom more so than my dad.
Did she sort of control the purse strings? In many households, mum was given a budget and in some cases, the entire pay packet was handed over to mum. How did that dynamic work?
Yeah, absolutely. My mother controlled the purse strings. If it was my dad, I think he's similar to myself, probably not as focused on the details of money, which is not a good thing. But my mom was certainly the one that controlled the purse strings.
You now have to elaborate on the chief executive of Sibanye-Stillwater not being, focused on the personal finances. I mean, Dali Mpofu has told us on this part of the program that he's not very good at billing, which as an advocate, which is not a good trait if you run your own business. But just tell us that.
Yeah. So I suppose what I'm referring to is I have a wife who's also a qualified company secretary, and my job doesn't allow me to focus in detail on my own personal expenses and wealth and so on, and that's managed for me. In the company, I have the same thing. I have a good group of executives who look after, you know, the finances of the company as much as I do. So it's a team effort.
So you're so busy looking after the finances of the company, but, you know, again, in a position as a chief executive, you can afford support and help. But do you take that help outside of the company? Do you get an independent individual involved?
Absolutely. I think, you know, investing and looking after your future is very complex. I mean, I did, after engineering, I did a BCom. And, you know, I did things like estate management and so on. But I know enough to know that I don't know enough to make decisions on my own. And, yes, in my personal life, we use advisors the same in the company. We've got financial advisors, you know, and even in legal aspects, we bring in advisors and so on.
Sure. How much time do you spend on your own family's money, on spending time with financial advisor? Is it a once a year thing? Do you go once a quarter? Or do you check on your statements every 5 minutes? I mean, what kind of money warrior are you?
Yeah, I'm not that sort of warrior. What I've learned to do is really remain focused on where I can make a contribution to my own wealth. And in typical public company, listed company fashion, that's about having all my eggs, which you would also say is not wise, but I know I stick to my knitting. I know if my eggs are in the basket that I'm looking after public money and I have the same sort of exposure, you know, I can only blame myself. So that's really one aspect of investing. Of course, making decisions around investments offshore, buying property and looking after long-term estate planning, that's where you take advice and of course a lot of trust is involved in those sort of decisions.
I mean, do you run a private stockbroking portfolio at all or not?
No, not at all.
No time?
No time, but I also like to be very focused on the company I'm managing on behalf of other people and looking after their money as well.
Has your best money decision been in backing yourself through your career? Because you've run various gold mining companies over many years.
Absolutely. I was about to say the contrary is true. Wherever I've stepped into another business, even if it's in the resources sector, I've invariably come short. So, you know, some of my earliest investments were in gold mines where I lost money. I made one investment into a clock manufacturer, funny enough, I made a bit of money. But generally, I've invested in wood businesses that have not worked, and I've really taken a decision to, you know, stay close to my core business and keep to my knitting.
Something that you know and you understand, which is digging deep holes in the ground and taking stuff out. Do you have bad money habits? I mean, do you have a whiskey habit, a gambling habit that your wife doesn't know about that you want to share with us? Maybe the horses,
I don't think I have any bad habits other than spending a lot of money on my hobbies.
Which are?
I'm into long-distance shooting, so... I have a number of very expensive firearms.
What's long distance shooting? Like in the movie Sniper, sort of like shooting over a kilometer sort of thing?
Yeah, shooting 1.5 to 2 kilometers, you know, having, you know, a variety of calibers to do that. I'm into flying fast cars. None of those are, the flying assets are probably decent assets, but cars are not a nice asset, but part of enjoying life.
Are they collectibles or do you just buy fast ones?
I don't like old stuff, so they're not really collectibles, and therefore they probably don't appreciate like old ones would. But no, I like the modern cars. I like to keep up with technology and what's the latest.
Okay, and that's a terrible, terrible, terrible habit, which is why you need to be a chief executive to earn the bucks to keep up the bad habit, I suppose. Does anything scare you about money?
I think a lack of money scares me, and I suppose some of my early childhood days, watching my parents battle, I actually had to work. I established a garage and service cars to fund my university fees. You know, that was a tough time. And not having enough money to me is a bit of a fear. I'm not obsessed with money. I think, you know, it makes life a lot easier than not having money.
Neil Froneman, thank you so much for coming in. The chief executive of Sibanye Stillwater on The Money Show this evening. Some insights into his attitude towards money, the way in which he manages his own money and some of his bird habits. Oof, don't buy cars. Except if you're Neil Froneman, and then you can. See, he's with Kasana's wife, Judy Dlamini, wouldn't let him buy cars, fancy cars. So in his office, when he was the first round chief executive, he had models of Bugattis and stuff. The play ones, the ones that cost 500 rand, not the ones that cost 5 million each. There's a dreadful scene in, playing out in Paris this evening in France. One of the most beautiful churches in the world is on fire. Notre Dame, the cathedral, is burning. Thousands of people are gathering in the streets of Paris. So there's going to be deep emotion this evening. It is, the church is on fire. It doesn't look like it's going to be salvaged at all. 1,000 years of history going up in smoke as we watch this evening. No doubt that'll be an eyewitness news.
The Money Show is brought to you by NetBank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. NetBank.
Well, that's it from The Money Show for this evening. We'll be back with you again tomorrow. Until then, good night.